So the approach I often take with students is, you know, be less concerned about fixing things. Be less concerned about making it all better. Families will solve their own problems most of the time. What we need to grow are those capacities to remain open, to be curious, to be able to point out to a family their remarkableness. And time and again, the students will come back saying, wow, the families are so surprised when I remark on what they're doing well. No one's ever said that to us before. No one's ever observed that. We've never sat down and talked about things the way we are now. And again, that comes back to the student creating a, being curious about that family and what do you think you do well and how is it that you've managed so well all this time? Can you think back to another experience and using those prior experiences to help them with a circumstance they're working with now? That's drawing on strengths. We don't say that in those words, but essentially that's what's going on. So.
Good morning. I'm Patricia O'Connor, the Director of Nursing and the Chief Nursing Officer of the McGill University Health Center. We're very proud to be a major sponsor for this particularly special Nursing Explorations this year. Just before I introduce our second plenary speaker, I'd like to thank Laurie for the incredible presentation that you just did. What you've done in your book, Strengths-Based Nursing, is to create a blueprint for everybody in this room and for nursing all over the world. Whether you're an administrator, whether you're a researcher, whether you're a clinician at the bedside or working in the community, or whether you're a nurse educator, the blueprint that you've talked about is bringing us back to our core. You talk about being true to who you are and true to your profession. And I thank you for the inspiration and the reminder of what it is to be a nurse. Thank you, Laurie. It is indeed a pleasure now to introduce our second keynote speaker for this morning, and that is Dr. Patricia Benner. Dr. Benner is a professor emerita at the University of California School of Nursing, a phenomenal nurse educator. Dr. Benner is best known, I think, by everybody in this room, and actually nurses all over the world, for her seminal work entitled From Novice to Expert, Excellence and Power in Nursing Practice, which has been translated into 12 languages. I'm not sure there's any other book through my career that I have seen continually referenced, not just in the past, but very much in the future, and again is serving as a really important blueprint for how we look at preparing and supporting nurses as they move through their career development. Dr. Benner has directed over 50 doctoral dissertations and pioneered the use of interpretive phenomenology in nursing. She is the director of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching's National Nursing Education Study entitled Educating Nurses, A Call for Radical Transformation, which is the first such study in over 40 years. Additionally, she's collaborated with the Carnegie Foundation in studies focused on the preparation of the professions, including clergy, engineering, law, and medicine. Again, her reach is well beyond the field of nursing. Dr. Benner is designated as a living legend of the American Academy of Nursing. She was elected as an honorary fellow to the Royal College of Nursing and the Danish Society for Nurses. And she has received two honorary doctorates. Dr. Benner is the first author of a book entitled Expertise in Nursing Practice, Caring, Ethics, and Clinical Judgment with Christine Tanner and Catherine Chesla. And she has co-authored 12 other books, including a second edition of Clinical Wisdom and Interventions in Acute and Critical Care, a Thinking in Action approach. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Dr. Patricia Benner, who's talking this morning on strengths-based nursing, recovering and reentering one's life world.
This indeed is an exciting day for all of us because we have just received from Dr. Gottlieb, Lori, an articulation of the deepest aspects of our practice. And what happens when you get a good articulation is that the reader says, oh, you've put into words what I've always known but didn't know how to put it. So now I just need a little help on figuring out where my, this must be it. Okay, so what I'm going to do is start out with trying to really describe what strength-based nursing overcomes in terms of our current thinking about health and healing. And what is the problem? I mean, medicine is very powerful in diagnosing and treating. And when we did the interdisciplinary study between medicine and nursing, I would always ask in the debriefing session, it seems to me that medicine is still really, really enchanted by diagnosing and recommending treating, not even treating, but recommending the treatment. And the physicians, educators would always say, yeah, that's what we're all about. And I would say, well, what about managing multiple chronic illnesses? Because that's a really important science. It's an important caring practice. And they would say, not so much. Nurses seem to be more interested in that. So if we don't step up to the plate, we can't look over our shoulder for someone else to do this. So nursing is always concerned about both the medical and the life world. Medicine gets its power by desituating, by stripping off the social. And it's interesting, one of my favorite medical philosophers is Cassell, and he notes that we can't really add on to the medical model because it gets its power from stripping off the social. And I've been trying to figure out how to, you know, like a barnacle, add the social to the medical model, but you really can't. It depends on this Cartesian split between the mechanical structure of the pathophysiology, the genome, the organ systems, and the cell. But nursing must attend to both the disease side and the pathophysiological side without letting it totalize us. And at times, it's been totalizing to us because it is a very powerful paradigm. But in order to recover, in order to promote health, in order to re-enter a fractured world after major injuries, one has to find and have constituted for them a livable life world. So nursing is concerned with both life world and nursing is concerned with medicine, of course. So strengths, as Lori defines them, and this is what I want to really highlight, is the sophistication in the approach that she's articulated. You'll notice that her strengths are neither inner or outer. She doesn't describe the super overcoming amazing person who overcomes it all against all odds, but rather the situated possibility of real people in real contexts. So she neither just focuses on inner or outer strengths, but always both simultaneously. So the strengths are moored in ways of being in the world, inner and outer resources, embodied skilled know-how, concerns, because our concerns, what matters to us, what we notice really sets up our own life world. We don't think about or notice our life world, and I know it's more of a European term than an American term, but it's the it is the environment. It is what we swim in if we were a fish, or it is the environment we play in if we were a cat. So the life world is our habitat, and our life world is constituted by what matters to us. Not necessarily always what we say matters to us, but what really matters to us in our actions and in our ways of being in the world. And one of the goals of strength-based nursing is to help the person rebuild, reintegrate, reconstitute a life world after having it fractured by an illness or major injury. So I want to talk about, you know, again, this is not an oppositional approach with either medicine or psychology, but if you go to a psychotherapist, the goals of psychology, not developmental psychology, but the goals of therapeutic psychology is to help you get free of no longer tenable commitments. And so it's a freedom from approach. And it's based on that enlightenment-based ideal of the autonomous, punctual person, unfettered by tradition, social ties, concerns, and loosed from an ethical stance on life, or some notions of, and also loosed from some notions of good that stand out as more or less important for the person's life. Now, as a psychologist and nurse, when Lori says autonomous, she really means agency. She doesn't mean an atomistic, all powerful, meaning created, punctual individual. So don't be confused by our language. I'm going to try to convince her to call it agency instead of autonomy. But that is the language of developmental psychology. So when psychology is doing its best work, it's freeing the person up from untenable commitments, from lifestyles that are not working for them, from defeated being stuck. And that's a very valuable therapeutic. But when patients typically come to us, they are in a vulnerable state or in a state in which they need to improve their health. And freedom from isn't enough. They have to focus on the freedom to and the freedom to be and the ability and capacity to take action, to change. Charles Taylor, okay, a Montreal kind of guy, my favorite philosopher, points out that the objectifying stance, which came along with Enlightenment science, fits in with the widespread modern view of the person as disembodied, disengaged, atomistic, or punctual, as in at points in time, rather than having a coherent continuity to their life. The person in this modern view, Cartesian view, it turns out, is distinguished from the natural social worlds so that they're like a private subject standing over against an objective world, all alone. If you were from California, you would have seen the S pictures of the world and then the individual standing out here alone, separate, looking at the world. But then California isn't really noted for its wonderful ways of being in the world all the time. So psychology and the Cartesian view of the person, that medical view of the person, distinguishes the person from natural and social worlds so that identity is no longer defined in terms of what lies outside in the person's world. It's not a bad definition of narcissism, is it? Where everything gets turned back in on the self. Strength-based nursing is an alternative to a normalizing deficit approach. And I really want to, I'm borrowing from Foucault here, I want to explain what I mean by normalizing. It's not a good thing. To understand the breakthrough of strength-based care, we must understand this bankruptcy of this mechanistic, instrumentalistic view of the person. And when we say we are about restoring the personhood, that's what we are about, not the instrumentalist cost-benefit analysis, rational calculator standing outside the world, acting like a sociopath almost. Normalizing seeks comparisons of how far short or how far above average or the norm an individual falls in their coping efforts, or their capacities, or their talents. Oliver Sacks draws this very dramatic picture of having really neuropsychologically examined and dismissed from social human existence the deficits of a very badly brain-injured patient. And then he has the grace to come out on the porch, and this autistic young woman, brain-damaged young woman, was going over the hymns and the arias and the music of this very of the classical sort, and she knew every song in the book, and yet all of his neuropsychology psychological testing of measuring deficits could never find that talent. Because it's designed to identify what's not there. And as I've talked to psychologists working with post-traumatic stress syndrome and traumatically brain-injured soldiers, they insist on their decontextualized testing. And I say to them, but you need to test them where they have a habitual skilled body and some tacit memory and some know-how. You're stripping them of their capacities with your isolated, decontextualized testing. Well, we'd like to, but it just wouldn't be scientific, they say to me. And I say to them, but what you're doing is inaccurate. You know, it's a misconception of what the person is able to do when they're embedded in their social, meaningful life world. The physicians at that particular conference and that particular conversation were saying, oh, well, you know, how they act when they're in a familiar, habitual situation, well, that's really epiphenomenal. It's not like an MRI, but yet it's real, you know. Why do they make the real so unreal? So methodologically, a normalizing gaze that looks for deficits only cuts out the specific historical content, events, and life world concerns of a family, person, or community. What is nursing about? We always used to say, well, one of my oncology nurse friends says, oh, you know, I asked them what matters to them. What frees them? What enchants them? Even if it's a little pebble they hold on to, bring it with you. You're going to need it. Chemotherapy is challenging. And that's a very different kind of stance. It's a very different time in your life than going in for working through a broken heart. So positive projects and freedom to be, to do and respond in particular ways to life demands. And I've given you this Oliver Sacks. He has plenty of stories like that, where it dawns on him that his decontextualized neurology testing is not the same as capacity to function. In fact, in his own life, he had in his book, A Leg to Stand On, I always think he writes nursing discourse, he talks about losing his rhythm. He could no longer walk. And his surgeon said, "Do you swim?" And he said, "Yeah, I swim." So he said, "Well, I want you to do some physical therapy in the pool." And the neurologist set it up so he would push Oliver in the swimming pool. And he knew he wouldn't drown because he could swim. And so he pushed him into the pool, and he got his rhythm back, that coordinated, integrated physiological functioning. Physical therapists are at a terrible disadvantage because they have no language for the social, sentient, skillful body with tacit memories that knows how to swim and knows how to dance. And with stroke patients, they can often do something that is habitual, skilled body that they cannot do if they're when they're asked deliberatively to do it. We've known forever they could do things like do a social gesture like covering a yawn. But if you say, "Please put your hand over your mouth," they wouldn't be able to do it. So that's tacit memory. That's still a capacity in the body that's there. And this is why, if I were in my own home territory, someone would say, "There she goes again." This is why strength-based care is not about the nursing diagnosis, which I hate with all my heart, called ineffective coping. To have a measure of effective coping requires you objectify, normalize traits and behaviors of good coping, regardless of what the person is coping with. In fact, if you had to list all the things people have to cope with, you wouldn't be able to develop those tests because that would run into the limits of formalism. It's philosophically impossible. So ineffective coping is an embarrassment. It is the opposite of strength-based care. A normalizing, deficit-oriented gaze does not allow you to explore what the person is coping with. For that, you have to have curiosity and find out. Once you discover what the person, family, community is coping with, you will seldom consider it ineffective. You will usually be in awe. I have two stories from Barbara Haberman Little's dissertation on patients with Parkinson's disease. And she had two paradigm cases that I'll never forget. One was a scientist, and one was a woman who was a political activist. And the scientist coped with his Parkinson's disease by seeking more and more control. He would carefully chart the effects of his medicine to determine when he was on and when he would be frozen. He calculated so he would never go out in the afternoon because he might be frozen and be embarrassed. And so he did his activity in the morning. And even though the social worker and counselor told him not to go to the support group in order to find out what happens next, that's exactly why he went, because he was a scientist. And he said, "If I could open my head and examine my brain and find out exactly what the deficits are, I would do it." And I do go to the social support groups just to see what's up next for me. And he managed very well, but he had to keep his world very, very tightly controlled and small. What was he coping with? Loss of control and stigma. He didn't want to be revealed Once you understand that, you can see how masterful he had become at coping with loss of control and stigma. The social activist, the political activist, her goal was to stay engaged in her political activism. So she found out when she could no longer sit down and participate in a meeting, she could stand on the edge and no one bothered or worried about her dancing or tremors or shaking. She found out when she was frozen and she couldn't walk, she could run. And she found out she could sign her name as long as she shook one foot and put all the tremors in that foot. You see what she was coping with? She was coping with the loss of engagement, the loss of activity. And there was recently a ridiculous story, I think it was in New York Times, about Parkinson's patients. They had discovered they could ride a bicycle. Well, those who had always ridden a bicycle can ride a bicycle. They can get back their rhythms because they have the sedimented habitual body. They do better when they walk on uneven ground, as in nature. Barbara and her colleagues have written what it's like to walk down a hall if you have Parkinson's. It's so disorienting because it's like floating almost in space. It's easier to go upstairs. So when we ask the question, what is the person coping with, we open up a whole new approach to focus on their strengths and help them develop capacities that match their concerns. Strength-based care is based on situated possibility, not on wild heroicism or overcoming all odds against all odds. So strength, as defined by Gottlieb, are neither purely inner or purely outside the individual. They as often focus on what the environment brings to the person, and that includes the social environment, as what the inner strength, the person brings. So strengths are always contextualized and influenced by what the person's life history, social world, what matters to them, what strengthens, encourages, supports, enchants. What enchants you? When's the last time you had a natal event in your life? You created something new happened in your life. What inspires, and so on. So strengths-based care is based on deeply understanding situated possibility. This is not an old-fashioned thinking makes it so nonsense. Attending to strength requires attending to loss, vulnerabilities, challenges and threats in the context of one's possibilities and strength. Lori, these are all quotes, but I think only a few of them have this tacky location because I've got the book on my Kindle, but I can seldom find my hard copy because I read it all over the house. Okay, so knowing is an essential quality in caring. It is only when the nurse comes to understand or truly knows a person that the nurse can be responsive and respond appropriately. Now, this know a person is to know the person in their situation that they're dealing with at this moment of time. And it may mean you need to talk to the family to find out what they're bringing with them into this situation. Curiosity enables a nurse to become more involved with the person and their situation. Okay, I really intend to move this forward. Oh, there we go. When the nurse chooses to look for commonalities, he will more likely be able to identify with the person and the family. Commonalities bind, whereas differences divide. And I want to suggest to you that we have made a fetish of a particular form of creating same, and that is the form of decontextualizing, breaking things down into their elements, preferably non-overlapping elements, and then creating a theoretical system to try somehow to wonk them back together again. That's called generalization. But for the human sciences, like Wittgenstein, I recommend looking for commonalities. I recommend looking for things that we share in our common humanity by being embodied. Even though we have different cultures, we're both embodied. By being finite, we do face death. Fortunately, we're able to deny it most of the time. And we're thrown into our own history of past, present, and projected into the future. Løgstrup, a favorite Danish philosopher of nurses, talks about, think about studying the sea urchin. You can do all of the cellular osmolarity studies you want of the functioning of the individual parts of the sea urchin so you can generalize. But if you never study the life cycle of sea urchins, individual sea urchins, you will never understand a sea urchin. Okay, so commonalities is a powerful human science form of generalization that doesn't depend on stripping down, decontextualization. Bruce, don't hate me, but it's a limited approach. It works great in the lab, but it's not good for the human sciences. So it's not generalization that we're looking for, but what are the commonalities? What are the common capacities and strengths? This is why we can become good coaches in nursing if we pay attention to all of how our patients go through their illness trajectories and what helps in coping them. So here's another caring viewed as a strength-based care. Promoting another person's growth through being with that person and creating the conditions in which the person can discover her own strengths and capacities. Skills of involvement and relationship building. A lot of people, when they talk about relational care, they will talk about the remedial aspects of figuring out self and non-self. Trust me, that's remedial and best works for the narcissist. For the caring professional, you have to go beyond that and develop positive projects of skills of engagement, both with the person and the problem. You have to develop respect and trust, and you have to develop the kind of empathy that is embodied and emotionally based on understanding the common humanity of another, rather than the intellectual, unemotional, detached, ferreting out what you think the other person might be thinking. So this is an embodied kind of stance from a common humanity. You need the skills of compassion and loving kindness. We found in our research, if nurses didn't develop good skills of involvement, they simply couldn't and didn't become expert nurses. Because expert nursing is not just about wizardry. If you don't have good skills of engagement, you don't stay engaged, you don't stay curious. Patients stop telling you things. They stop disclosing things. And so you don't have the information you need to become an expert nurse. So compassion is a way of expressing one's own humanity and is the foundation of kindness. It is the emotion evoked by the suffering of others and an acknowledged awareness of their suffering, accompanied by a desire to alleviate or at least mitigate the suffering, to support, to shore up, to stand alongside. Self-kindness, please, no martyrs in strength-based care, okay? No victims. Because self-kindness is essential in strength-based care. A self-kindness extends kindness to oneself the way you want to extend it to others. I have to pause and tell you an educational story that you may have heard me tell before, but it's a cautionary tale. This nurse graduated from her doctoral program, went directly into teaching, and of course tried to teach her students everything she had learned in her doctoral program in the first quarter with a kind of trickle-down toughness, the same way she had been taught in her doctoral program. Well, of course, what happened, the students' anxiety spiraled, and by the second quarter, they were on the ceiling. And she gets a call from one of the students who is on a clinical unit, and she's in tears. She says, "You have to come. The patient wants to get up, and she's not supposed to get up. She has a broken back. You've got to come. I can't manage this situation." So she goes. And she finds out, indeed, this student needs shoring up. So she goes in the room, and she becomes a nurse. And she begins talking to the patient. And she says, "Well, when did you fall? Ah, and what happened? Ah, and where does the brace hurt?" And she began to bend back the little gouging areas of the brace. And the next thing you know, the patient is pirouetting over to the bedside commode. And the teacher's thinking, "This is fabulous role modeling. Great job I'm doing here." She walks out of the room with a student, and the student does look at her in awe. But what she says is, "Oh, I wish you could treat us like that." And it transformed this teacher's teaching. She realized she simply couldn't teach in a relational way that was antithetical to nursing care. Mindfulness, tolerance, and acceptance of oneself, attunement of self, other, and situation. Think of all of the frenzied time when you've made one of those pathological moves of helping, when you wanted to be the omnipotent rescuer and fix everything, and how anxious-making that really is. And then you realize, no, I can only offer and only be with and only support what the patient can do. Kindness and compassion are required to avoid pathologizing harm and responses to harm. You see, the deficit model will treat harm like the source of the problem rather than considering the actual content of the harm itself. But why wouldn't war, tragedy, abuse be formative and change one's ways of being in the world? Why should they be able to erase the past as if it never happened? Unfortunately, that's how Freud viewed grief, that it was over in 2 years if you were really healthy and not neurotic. We now know that it doesn't really ever go away if you lose a loved one or a child. Grief is an ongoing thing. So we have to stop pathologizing harm and trauma. We have to have the courage, the physical courage, of putting oneself at risk in the process of saving others' lives. In our study of the care of the wounded warriors in Iraq and Afghanistan, we are blown away by the moral courage of the buddies, of the nurses. You have to have the moral courage to stand up for patient rights and notions of good care. We're blown away as the nurses who initially say, I can't possibly take care of a combatant, and then say, I didn't think I could do it. But once I saw him, he was a human being, and I knew how to care, and I responded. Vital courage, the willingness to accompany people through difficult, ambiguous times when you can't fix it. That's what it is to be human. We can't fix everything in the human condition. We can't. So healing relationships contain wisdom and strengths and skill. It's the ability to discover the clinical imagination to see the person's strengths, to help them develop new strengths. One of my doctoral students did an amazing study of recovering from a stroke, and she found that stroke patients recover and have plateaus, and then go up again and have another plateau. She had one man that was so goal-oriented and so driven, and he was an engineer, I'm sorry about that. And so he made little goals for himself, and he would push, but when the plateau happened, he would get discouraged. So then she explained plateau. You've got to keep going during the plateau. The other thing, he was preparing for his daughter's wedding and the father-daughter dance, and he really just thought he couldn't do it. But the dance comes, the music comes, and suddenly he's waltzing with his daughter. That often happens in care of the elderly. They can often dance and recover former skills in ways that you wouldn't anticipate, especially if they've been dancers. So you use strengths to counterbalance the effects of vulnerabilities and weaknesses. And I love your phrase in your book that we need to focus on the flowers and not just the weeds. I love orchids. I raise orchids. But when at times I have been overextended, taking on too much, you wouldn't understand, I can be feeling quite burnt out and look at the orchid and only say, ugh, you need to be watered, right? Ordinarily, I see the flower. I dressed our daughter once when she was about 5, that wonderful magic age. I always dressed her for a Sunday school. And apparently, I always smiled at the result. This day, I was concerned about a friend who was dying. I was frown on the face. My daughter looked at me at the end, and she said, you forgot to smile. How often do we forget to smile? And how often do we see the orchid needs watering rather than the flower? Or the weeds we have to pull without noticing the flowers? So in the book, those awkward locations, strengths are the light that provide a window into the human spirit and define humanity. So internal strengths, motivation, courage, resilience, and more. External strengths, community of memory, finances, connections, support, religion, spirituality, goals, concerns, and more. Attending to life world meanings and concerns, and I would refer you to Amy Nyland's wonderful narrative. She says, I was thinking about goals. I got the impression that she hadn't been encouraged to have goals beyond the medical management kind of goals. It's another problem with the medical model. It's totalizing because it systematically excludes the life world and the strength story. if there were things she was that she was aiming for in the rest of her life, it might give her a reason to dig into the medical management side and bring the illness down to size. Amy, I love the language. It's part of her life, the medical part, but it's not everything. One of the images I love is a mother standing at the neonatal intensive care looking down at this fairly fragile neonate premature baby saying, I just couldn't get through this without you. It's the paradox, the wonderful paradox of being human. So reintegrating the mind-body world, and I really use that intentionally to not think of us as a private subject standing over against a world. We inhabit the world, we dwell in it. Illness, that human experience of disease and sickness, sickness is that social recognition of illness. Both illness and sickness close down or alter one's usual ways of being in the world. So life worlds, this environment that we inhabit, if we were a fish, it would be the water we swim in, include family and social networks, community, concerns, life projects, embodied skill know-how, comportment, embodied intentionality. By that I mean if you go and you want to open a door, you just know how to do that. It's embodied intentionality. If someone who has a cognitive deficit is tacitly buttoning their shirt, they can get through it quite well. If they get interrupted and they think of putting the button through the, deliberately through the hole, they'll be blocked. But if they move into their habit button and do it tacitly, they can do it. How closely do you observe tacit skills and strengthen those? Understandings and skills are lodged in the body, in the habitus, the sedimented meanings. To re-enter a world altered by injury, vulnerability, requires strengths, and it also requires healing environments and relationships that facilitate and foster strength. And here I'm going to tell you a story. I'm involved in this large military story of the care of wounded warriors in this rapid, highly efficient transport-based care, but dizzying, disorienting transport care. Alva Noah has written a book called Out of Our Heads. I really recommend it for those of you who work with cognitively impaired patients. He says, the last 25 years have witnessed the gradual shaping of an embodied, situated approach to the mind. But this has been ignored in neuroscience, in mainstream linguistics, and more generally in the domain of consciousness study. Well, certainly the MRI neuroscientist who said, well, that's epiphenomenon, what the person can do in context. Really hasn't looked at the last 25 years of the cognitive science research. They're out of date. So in addition to the theoretical grids of measurable aspects and features of the mind or the brain-mind, we need descriptive language and disclosive practices that help us see what Lori was talking about, that allow social practices, embodied intentionality, common, taken for granted meanings that are strength building, habits, rituals, practices, and everyday life to show up in our patients' lives. This would be to dissolve the mind-body world problem. So, these are the theoreticians I'm drawing on, but all of our patients have embodied skilled know-how. At Massachusetts General, one of the occupational therapists was working with a patient who had very severe anoxic brain damage from a resuscitation effort. But she found he had good tacit memory, and he was operating in his adolescent world. He didn't remember his wife, but he could still dribble a basketball. He was kind of in his high school realm. And she decided to try to use his really well-functioning tacit memory to help him deal with his cognitive conceptual deficits. And so she went to Stanley Schachter, the leading thinker on tacit memory. And she said, well, what can I do with this clinically? He said, I don't know anybody who's tried to do anything with it clinically. And they finally came up with a couple of studies. And she did this descending cue approach with just deep habitual training, taking away one cue at a time to help him get onto the computer. And finally, when he really had it ingrained, sedimented in his body, so that it was tacit memory, he would still say, when she would say, well, let's have you get on the computer now, he says, I don't know how. She says, it doesn't matter, just mess around and see what happens. Just experiment with it. And he could always, by tacit memory, get on the computer. And then she extended that into other areas. So we all have a habitus. If we were Japan, if we were Japanese, we would know what the status of the bow and the we would need. We would have a skilled know-how about bowing. We do have a skilled know-how about how far or how close we stand in North America. We all have styles of comportment. So now I want to tell you a story from this study. This woman brought her fighter pilot husband, who had had 5 years of intensive, best paid rehabilitation you could get. And she finally brought him to the VA and said, he's still not speaking. He was a brilliant man. I know he can recover his speech. And so the nurse brilliantly said, tell me what he was like. Oh, he was a mathematician. He was a whiz at math. He loved math. And he was a workaholic. And he had to always be doing something. So she told him, the wife told the nurse about the man's life world. And so she goes in and she says to him something simple like, what's 2 and 2? And he said, 4. And it's still there. It's still there. That's a strength. You find a strength and you fan it, right? You give it more oxygen. You liven it. And she said, you know, I have a problem. The batteries sometimes run out on our IV metrics, our IVometers, and I need someone to check if the batteries are full or about to go out. So that was his assignment. He did fine. And he said, and then she also worked, of course, with her team of speech therapists. They all got in, the occupational therapists, they all got in on this. And he finally said to her, well, my speech is coming. Maybe I should deliver water so I can practice. And so then he was delivering water to patients. And then he just kept growing. The speech kept coming back. And one day, the nurse said, stopped him in the hall. She said, you know, you are contributing so much to this team. I've made you a name badge because you're one of the team. And you should have a name badge. And he looked at her and choked up. And he said, this is the happiest day of my life. That's situated possibility. And if you don't look for it, trust me, you won't find it. One of my students, Lee Smith Battle, when she was telling the results of her study of unmarried teenage moms, and they lived in the inner city in the worst part of across the tracks, a dangerous inner city neighborhood, and she was describing these young women in a research presentation, and she was identifying their strengths. And she was talking about their mothering practices learned from their grandmother. And there were these, it was an audience of public health nurses, And they said, oh, we wish we had patients like that. They did, of course, but they never, ever met them. So our concerns, our skills, our habits, our practices determine what we're able to notice, and they organize our everyday life world. The TBI, the dementia, the trauma, I want you to associate what I say about TBI and dementia with the elderly, with vascular dementia particularly. Because there's so much capacity in the person's life world and their tacit memory if we're able to draw on it. And you have to get the family history, you have to get the person's history, what enchants them. We had a story of a patient, a Marine, who was coming out of the coma and he was just fighting all day, typical coming out of a coma, right? And he was just thrashing, and oh, the nurse was exhausted, he was exhausted. And at the end of the day, he said to the nurse, I need the hymn, I need the hymn, I need the hymn. And the nurse says, Marine, he was also military, he understood, he must mean the Marine hymn. And so he found it on his iPod and played it for him. And watched this man coming out of the coma after about 12 hours, just organize his body to the hymn, gathering up meanings, gathering up muscles, gathering up the habit body, returning him, resituating him in his world. Noe says in that wonderful little book, Out of Our Heads, without habit, there is no calculation, no speech, no thought, no recognition, no game playing. Habits are situational and environmental, not only mental or embodied. In other words, they're not like traits or talents. He says, a habit is not merely a disposition to act or an automatic, unthinking tendency. It is a responsiveness to the environment in which we find ourselves. If the trail is paved over, as we do in our clinical worlds, I added that. If the trail is paved over, if the familiar landmarks are removed, our habits can be frequently extinguished. We have to take that seriously. In the early stages of the patient's brain injury or coming out of a coma, the patient feels often deworlded, desituated. They feel almost as if they are falling. And so in order to work with their strengths, you need to know what strengths there are in his community of memory, in the life world. I worked with these notions with my surrogate father, who was 92 and had cardiovascular dementia, and I hired a brilliant physicist who was from Russia, who had the same accent that Harry's own mother had. Okay, so I was thinking. And so she bugged all the doors in his house so he wouldn't be constrained, but if he left, she would show up out of the door he came. And she found out that in the evening, they had this very strong ritual. They sit down, they eat the meal, he takes his pills, he picks up the paper, he goes to the bedroom. If anything happened to disrupt this ritual, he dropped his paper, the phone rang. By the time he got to the bedroom, he would be falling in his mind. You know, he would, Genya, I need to go home, I need to go home, I need to go home. And she, of course, initially had tried to tell him, well, you are home, look around, that's your bedspread. Didn't work. So she's, okay, Harry, come on, let's go home. And they would go to the car, they would drive around the familiar neighborhood, They would come up the familiar drive. He would step up the steps that he knew so well to the living room, and then he would no longer feel lost. He was at home because his body could grasp it. It was a perceptual grasp of being home. That's why it's so important to find out about the patient's habits. So the nurse and the healthcare team need to understand the injured person's life world, their sources of meaning and comfort. The patient's ability to reenter a familiar world and constitute a new life world are often disrupted. And if you remember nothing else I've said, I want you to remember this next sentence. Patients can often respond to meaningful habits, memories, skills, and relationship when they can't conjure them up on their own. For example, a patient with dementia's world will shrink, and you'll look around and you'll think, oh my God, they have the TV on blaring all day long, they aren't getting out enough, and they won't be able to, even though it's killing them to be in that environment. So you say, oh, come on, let's do lunch, and you take them out to lunch. You expand the world. Come on, you've always been so artistic. Let's do beads together. Let's do some clay together. So it's the community of memory that is responsible for setting up the world for the patient to reenter. And they can respond when they can't constitute it. They can't tell you what's important any longer. For Harry, one of his points of enchantment was the movie, The Love Affair. But his choice of that version of that film was with Deborah Kerr. And so every day, in addition to opera, which he loved and dwelt in, he would watch The Love Affair because it captured his own shipboard romance with his beloved wife who had passed on. And so if Genya called me and said, the television's not working, well, that was a life world emergency. We rushed right in with a new television. You know, you couldn't go a day without feeling the feeling of dwelling in The Love Affair because it was so central to his memory. And the fighter pilot and the Marine story are another example of that. Skills of dwelling, and this is the existential skills of dwelling in place, embodied points of enchantment, spirituality, ethos. Sirkka-Liisa Ekman in Sweden has discovered that the Finnish patients in the Swedish nursing home often go back to only Finnish, and then they feel trapped, bewildered, and frightened if they only hear Swedish. So she's reintroduced Finnish for them so that they can dwell in the Finnish. Interestingly enough, her daughter, who's Finnish and Swedish and married a Polish man, decided they would be very strict. They would only speak Swedish from the mother and Polish from the father to the child, so he wouldn't be confused, and so he would learn both languages as his mother tongue. But the daughter discovered she couldn't mother in Swedish because she had been mothered in Finnish. The lullabies, the stories, and she just had to do that in Finnish. So favorite movies and novels and paintings and scripture and religious rituals such as praying, saying rosary, or Shabbat, or gardening, or using the computer, or holding a baby or a child, reading the paper. I mean, there are so many things. One of the Swedish nurses told the story of the woman who loved hats, and she hadn't spoken. And she brought in her new hat, and the woman smiled and started singing. So we need to preserve and extend existential skills of dwelling. And I think, don't you think, that's a threat for all of us with our texting? I can't be bothered to really have a face-to-face exchange. Text me. Bodily sets and routinized skills to act, like at mealtime, buttoning a shirt, social gestures, distance standing, all of these are tacit memories. All of these things are a kind of bodily grasp of social situations and place. And so we need to be attuned to the social climate. A Swedish nurse has done research on the sort of feeling of safety that a patient experiences when, for example, she thinks her purse has been stolen. People are always stealing my books, my purse, you know what I mean? And she goes to her friends and she confronts them, and the nurse comes up and she said, "Oh, we don't allow stealing here. We always get to the bottom of it. We will find your purse. Don't worry. That's something we take very seriously. And let's go to your room." Do you see what I mean? She kept the moral climate of stealing being not sanctioned. And that reassured the woman. Oh, she's not in a place where stealing is. I mean, can you imagine how you'd feel if you felt that way? Experience of time, both nonlinear and linear dimensions. For example, biographical time is narrative time, lived time. Quality of time. Sometimes the Italians are especially good at getting into the eternal now, the qualitative experience of time. Ritual time, meals, social celebrations, seasons, holidays. Those are all skills, existential skills of dwelling in time. Meditative nonlinear time, daily orienting time, nap time, tea time, work time. There is a story of this man who used to get just furious every day after lunch in the nursing home because he imagined it was like his factory, and these people simply didn't go back to work after lunch. So the head nurse figured this out, and she said, "Come on, we're workers. Let's go to my office and let's get back to work. Lunch is over." And she would do that, and he would feel calm. Otherwise, he would just feel beside himself because people were lollygagging around. And now we know reality orientation needs to have the question asked, whose reality? And you don't get to declare the reality. So you need to respond to a familiar sense of dwelling place and to understand what it feels like to be lost, to fall, to be dizzy, and lose your sense of place. And sometimes the only way you can get it is that skilled, embodied returning to place. And some people can dwell in worlds sustained by an active community of memory. What if all of our nursing care facilities really took a life world kind of history and could talk about points of enchantment with the residents? Kettle Norman from Norway has followed patients with vascular dementia, and he has found that they have times of very purposeful movements. And he followed one person on the bus, and this man walked in the restaurant, and the daughter at the restaurant said, "Papa, what are you doing here?" So these ritual sense of places. So now I want to leave you with this very short video clip, which is on the web. And it's a film on being in the world, being in a life world. And I think it is a great way to get a strength, to get an idea of the strength that resides in all of our craft. You can think of yourself as the nurse involved in a meaningful world of the craft and skill of caregiving. So I'm going to trust the audiovisual people to pull this off for me. Good.
It doesn't occur to most people to worry about this, but philosophers are very concerned to understand how it is that we engage with objects in the world.
What are the most important things to master?
Practice, experience, knowing your boat.
There's an element of luck, and then probably have some balls, too.
Skillful coping is being able to do things with your hands, like painting or handwriting or woodworking. Oh, sports is another swell example.
You're interacting with everything.
You add a little red pepper and give it a little zing.
Something that you learn how to do, but when you are asked how you do it, you can't actually say, how am I trying to hit the ball? I don't know, I'm just swinging the bat. But not just swinging the bat, you may be talking to somebody who's really good at it.
Theories of the mind have been put to the test with the development of the computer.
That became a real research program in the 1950s, the idea that you could generate intelligence in a machine.
Once I was really brave. They said, we've got a car that will drive on the street and with no human driver. And I said, I doubt it. And they said, we're telling you we've got it. And I said, I'm telling you that you haven't got it. You're lying. And I was right. I mean, it was just that reality was on my side.
What we are at bottom, much more fundamental than our being thinking subjects, is that we care about something. Something matters to us.
Dice que no quiero más la, que no quiero.
La guitarra, como cualquier instrumento, es una conversación entre dos, entre la guitarra y el guitarrista.
There's those times when you'll get too inside, and those jazz masters will be sitting in the audience. Those jazz legends will come out and like, hey man, connect.
Cooking is like religion. Brews don't know what will make a cook, and sermons make a saint.
Rules work by ignoring details.
People think of recipes. She is the recipe.
A ver, a mi novia vengo pa decirle que la quiero. Porque esta noche.
There probably is a correlation between being very skillful at something, being a master of something, and finding things in the world which are deeply significant, deeply meaningful, and essential to your being who you are.
So Annie and I are back again just for a quick few announcements before we start the break. First of all, a huge thank you to both Dr. Gottlieb and to Dr. Benner for those wonderful and inspiring presentations. Thank you to you both. We do ask that all of you save your questions for after the break. Lori and Patricia have agreed to join the panel for where a question and answer period has been planned. So just hold on to your questions. You will have the opportunity to interact with them. We have another featured presentation, or big feature for us anyways, at the McGill bookstore table during the refreshment break, where Dr. Lori Gottlieb will be hosting a book signing at that table. But this is a morning. This is during the morning break only, so for those of you who are interested in going over to that table, we do invite you to go over there during the next 45 minutes during the break. We also ask you to take your time to enjoy the refreshments and visit our exhibitor tables. You will note that there's this bright pink card in your participant bag. I've been told that if you fill out this card, note your favorite exhibitor. Not only will the exhibitor win a prize, but you also have the opportunity to win a one-night deluxe package at the Auberge and Spa in West Brome. So good luck to all of you, and we'll see you back here in about 45 minutes.
Pour l'auditoire qui parle français, alors nous aimerions remercier nos nos guest speakers de ce matin. Je crois que nous allons avoir beaucoup d'inspiration et nous allons pouvoir repartir avec une approche probablement très enrichie. Alors, on remercie nos guest speakers encore une fois. Nous allons nous arrêter pour 45 minutes pour prendre des rafraîchissements. Alors, vous allez avoir une opportunité pour aller voir nos kiosques. Nous avons un concours, donc vous avez besoin de remplir le petit carton rosé pour indiquer le kiosque que vous avez préféré et vous avez une chance de gagner une fin de semaine au Spa Bromont. Alors, nous vous invitons à faire le tour des kiosques et Dr. Lori Gottlieb sera aussi disponible pour signer son ouvrage « Strength-Based Nursing Care, Health and Healing ». Alors, nous vous revoyons dans 45 minutes. Bonne pause.